Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As we go to air, the House is set to begin last-ditch deliberations on the so-called fiscal cliff following the convening of the Senate 1 hour ago. Keith Poole, the chair of political science at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at UC San Diego, joins us. He is the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Equal Rights, and Ideology and Congress. We will discuss the role of ideology and money in the latest standoff between a president who promised to make the rich pay their fair share of taxes and the Republicans who are determined to protect tax cuts for the top 1%. Then we will speak with a former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, William Vizard, about how the NRA protects criminals while claiming to protect the rights of law-abiding citizens. We will discuss how Congress, at the behest of the NRA, have passed laws that make it impossible for law enforcement to share data on guns used in crimes, who sells them, buys them, and uses them in committing murders and armed robberies. Then finally, we'll go to Amman, Jordan, and speak with Dawood Katoub, who is a leading Palestinian journalist who is at the forefront of revealing what could be an historical shift in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute over land and sovereignty that has been deadlocked for over 40 years. We will discuss the secret negotiations going on between the Israelis and the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan that could lead to a breakthrough deal, first reported by Dawood Katoub's article in The Atlantic, "Are Palestinians Ready to Share a State with Jordan?" Joining us now is Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science and the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Poole.
Yep, glad to be here.
And the Senate is convened an hour ago, and the House is just convening as we go to air. So do you expect anything to happen here? I mean, this is last-minute brinksmanship over a sort of an apocalyptic idea of a fiscal cliff that is somewhat imaginary, but it seems to have captured the attention of the press, and they've gone along with this notion that the ship of state's about to fall off the cliff. What's your sense of whether anything serious will be accomplished in the next few hours?
I don't think they will pass a bill today. Probably, if the Senate does pass something, it'll be late tonight. And if the Senate does pass something, it will be taken up in the House tomorrow. I have not seen whether or not they've actually made a deal yet. And even if they have made a deal, it'll be fairly small and not deal with the spending cuts and most of the other tax issues besides just the marginal rates probably and the AMT. And probably they will probably extend the unemployment, but that's not clear.
So when Senator Lindsey Graham says that the president won, what's he saying here? It doesn't look like anybody's won here, particularly the American people.
The election was essentially a standoff with slight edge to the Democrats. But then again, the Republicans in the House, after being fairly heavily criticized for 2 years, only lost 8 seats. Republicans fielded very, very bad senatorial candidates and ended up losing seats rather than gaining seats. And President Obama won, even though he got roughly about 5 million fewer votes than he did in 2008. So the public is just generally unhappy, and the public is conflicted. It's the old problem of they want their cake and they want to eat their cake as well. So they don't want to. It's fine to raise taxes, but as long as you don't raise my taxes and don't cut my benefits, cut somebody else's benefits. So politicians basically their main interest in life is being reelected. So they will keep repeating the same old stories to people as long as they keep getting elected. So we're in a real fix because the public opinion is inconsistent, and so it's no surprise that these people can't deal with the underlying problems.
Well, Keith Poole, it seems that the standoff, it seems to me, well, let me put it this way. It seems that the idea that this is about ideologies is very questionable because it also, I think, is about political patronage. I can't understand any other reason why the Republicans are going to the mat for the wealthiest 1%. They did it before with the debt ceiling crisis, which has led to the sequester, led to this so-called fiscal cliff. And that's the line that they've drawn. And they humiliated their own speaker the other day, who tried to come up with a compromise because they didn't want to raise taxes on the wealthy. And on the other side, you've got a president who ran his I think his main campaign theme was that the rich have to pay their fair share of taxes. So isn't that what this is essentially about?
Yeah, but it's basically a cartoon issue because it's an ideological cartoon because the amount of money we're talking about here is just is so small given the size of our problems that this is all symbolic. The president campaigned on raising taxes on people above $250,000, and the Republicans have not gone along with a tax increase since the Bush tax increases in 1990. And so they're determined that sort of, basically a scorched earth standoff. My hunch is, though, that if McConnell and Reid get a deal where the top rate is $400,000 and above, then I think you'll get a majority of Republicans in the House will go along with that. And with the Democrats, that'll be enough to pass it in the House.
So that would mean actually less revenues again, right?
It would be the same exact tax code now, only there would be a tax increase on I believe, these things are always slippery. I think it's family, it's household income of 400 grand and above. And so you get that additional revenue, but it's really not very much, given the scale of the entitlement problem we have. So, yeah, it's very, very, very small potatoes.
Again, I'm speaking with Keith Poole, who is a distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Rights, Ideology and Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. And we're talking about this latest brinksmanship as the new year approaches and the so-called ship of state goes over the so-called fiscal cliff. There is, of course, a cynical interpretation of what the Tea Party caucus in the Congress are about, since they're the ones that held up the so-called Plan B that Speaker Boehner offered a few days ago and humiliated him. There's a notion that maybe they want to go over the fiscal cliff. That way, the tax rates will then go back up. And then instead of talking about increasing taxes, they'll be able to argue that they're actually talking about decreasing taxes. Is there anything to that?
I think that's true for some members. Yeah, I think that is right. But a lot of this is just sort of, dead enders. They basically refuse to vote to increase taxes. So it's a symbol. It's symbolism. And so my guess is that if they go past, technically the taxes go back up on January 1. And then the automatic cuts kick in on January 2nd. The new Congress convenes January 3rd. So that if they go past tomorrow evening, New Year's Eve, without passing something, then my guess is they'll pass something fairly quickly in the first week of January. That will be something like the $400,000 top rate is my guess.
So this is being in many ways cast as a battle between the Tea Party people who are influenced by Grover Norquist's pledge, and he's this obscure fellow that seems to have inordinate influence over the Congress, but largely because he can back up his threats and run people against the wavering Congress people in primaries, because he's supported, Grover Norquist is supported by some big money. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Again, we get down to the question of how much we're talking about ideology and how much we're talking about political patronage. And I'm curious to know whether there is a recognition there that this is really about the people who back Grover Norquist, as opposed to Grover Norquist himself. They've attributed great powers to him. What's your reading on that whole?
Well, this is the great irony. Norquist signed off on Boehner's bill because the bill was written, this is the $1 million top rate, the bill was written in such a way that your net, if you had that family income of $1 million or more, your net was going to be lower or unchanged. And he signed off on it, so that where it went off the rails was the Club for Growth and the Heritage Society. People threatened to run people in primaries against those members who would vote for Boehner's bill. The irony here is that rich people are split, because a lot of rich people, for example, in New York and Los Angeles and the big urban areas, are social liberals, and so they tend to back the Democrats. And so it's not just a monolithic kind of thing. And ditto big business, which is also split, and some big businesses back Democrats, some back Republicans. Where you see the real difference is small business, which tends to be overwhelmingly Republican. So that, what was key here is these outfits like the Club for Growth threatening to primary people. And that's the reason why it'll be much easier for them to vote after the first of the year on this kind of on a bill than it is now. But we're by no means, it's going to get even worse as we get into the later part of January.
And that's because, I take it, Keith Poole, that the debt limit comes up again. And the debt limit, it's the last time the debt limit was used, and it was actually used for the first time, to my knowledge, as a weapon, which, of course, brought about an increase in the cost of debt to the U.S. government. So it's a self-inflicted wound, because if you go to the mat and put up for ransom the full faith and credit of the United States government in terms of your political leverage, you end up making our debt more expensive, which is exactly the opposite of what you're proclaiming to be as a deficit hawk, surely.
Right, but the problem we've got is that we're running deficits on the order of about $1 trillion a year, and the reason why we're able to do that is that essentially we have 0% interest. I mean, all the experts agree that we have to do something about the rate of growth, especially of Medicare. Social Security is a relatively easy fix. The president has already agreed to use the chained CPI, which is the right adjustment to make, and that would fix Social Security, would be an easy fix. The big problem here is Medicare, which is growing exponentially. And because of the demographic shift in the United States, my generation, I was born in 1947, is starting to retire. And we're simply, most of this unless we can get economic growth back up to rates of around 4%, there's just simply no way that we can sustain this level of spending for many more years.
But how much is there realism? I mean, I wish that we were having a realistic debate instead of this kind of kabuki theater that's going on, because it's obvious that we need to increase revenues and that everybody should pay a little more in tax. And now, you can make the argument that we shouldn't do this right away because the economy is still recovering, and that austerity is the worst thing you can possibly do in terms of extinguishing a recovery. But there's this element that we talked about a little while ago, Keith Poole, of the Grover Norquist business. I mean, he's famous for saying he wants to shrink government down to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. So is that, how much of this is just ideology? Again, I get back to this division between ideology and money. I recall in the presidential primary on the Republican side, all the candidates were asked a simple question, you know, would you agree to $9 in spending cuts for $1 increase in revenues? And none of them agreed to it. I mean, it's like, do these people understand mathematics?
Well, it's all ideological. I mean, it's ideology. In the primaries because you have to appeal to the a very small slice of the electorate that actually participates in primaries, you end up being forced to take these rather extreme positions, and it is all ideological. The thing is that there's no way that these entitlements can be cut very drastically for the very simple reason that people love them, and the main beneficiaries are middle-class Americans. Right now, a person retiring, say if I was able to retire, even though I've been working basically since 1965, if I lived my expected lifespan, the current estimate is you get out triple in real dollars you paid in. And that's the source of our problems, is that we've made these promises and we haven't funded, we haven't put aside the money to pay for them. One of the biggest frauds that has been perpetrated on the American public is that the politicians long ago spent all the surpluses. There are no trust funds. Those are a fiction. They exist only in the sense of a bookkeeping entry, and you can find it online. Non-negotiable, non-tradable securities. And if it's a non-negotiable, non-tradable security, it isn't real. So that politicians and both political parties over the last 30 years have spent everything that came in. That means that we have to pay for Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid out of current tax revenue. There are no savings. This means that the crisis is only going to continue to get worse and worse and worse with every passing year. And the two political parties are so severely polarized, it's going to be extremely difficult to come to a resolution of this because of this standoff in the electorate, where the Republicans control the House and probably will control the House until the next census. And the Democrats seem to have the edge in winning the presidency. So we're in real trouble.
Right, but Keith Poole, aren't we in trouble also because one party doesn't want to raise revenues and pay for the money that's already been raided? The other one does, and people have paid in. It's immoral to steal from the American people who are expecting something they paid for. Why not get some? I know the revenues that you get from taxing the wealthy are not going to close the gap
but it's a place to start, and maybe corporate taxes as well, or at least how much money they're hiding offshore. I mean, there are ways to go after the money without having to go after just Social Security, and you would think that Obama's signature Medicare Affordable Care Act would have done something about the out of control medical costs, but apparently not.
No, I think, look, there's no question that you can get more money. I mean, after all, it'd probably be a good thing just to let the Bush tax cuts completely expire, because that they did is they took so many people off the tax rolls that it's really caused a huge shortfall. So yes, you can get more money, but the difficulty is that the amount of money we're going to need to pay for Medicare, for example, is so staggering that you would have to raise taxes across the board on all the way down to, like, adjusted gross income of at least 25 or 30. You have to raise all those taxes substantially in order to get the cash. And I don't know whether or not, you know, the problem is that you got to have more revenue, and you've got to means test these entitlements. And so far, the political will is not there to do this.
Right.
One side doesn't want to raise revenue, and the other side doesn't want to cut benefits.
Right. And the
standoff.
And just in closing, then, Keith Poole, the one solution, which wasn't even on the table during the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare debate, was the idea of single-payer, a health system which the rest of the developed world has, and they pay about 6 to 8% of GDP on health care and have much better results, and we're up to about 18% of GDP, and it's growing on health care. So there's a solution staring us in the face, but not one that has snowball's chance in hell of ever getting even on the table.
No. Yeah. I don't think you'll ever see single payer here.
Right.
If anything, what'll happen is you will see a two-tier system emerge very quickly in the United States. This is the concierge system.
Right.
Because you cannot, under our laws, you cannot stop people from purchasing something like health services. So you'll see very quickly a two-tier system emerge, and it'll be a big mess.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Keith.
You bet. All right.
Again, I've been speaking with Keith Poole, who is the distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and Of Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool